Good morning? No. I don't even know. I just know that you're not in my time zone. So certainly not good morning. Actually, it's about to hit noon here. But Jazz, good afternoon is my assumption. How are you doing?
I'm really well. Thank you. How are you, Jordan?
I'm very well. Thank you for coming on. Why don't you, I mean, selfishly, even for me, because I've been following you for a very long time, and I'm very excited to have you into chat. Tell the listener a bit about your background, how you got into fitness, the classic podcast get to know you phase. Let's start with that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, likewise, I've been following you for a long time and loving everything you do. So I am a health and fitness coach. I'm from the southwest of England, but I live in London at the moment. And I guess in terms of how I got into all of this, so I was throughout my kind of youth and my teens, I was always very kind of lots of competitive sport. I played kind of netball at quite a high level. I don't think you guys have netball, but it's like akin to basketball, I guess, is like the closest thing I can compare it to. No.
Okay. I'm going to do a quick Google in the background.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So a lot of that, so like kind of a lot of like kind of training and that kind of thing all throughout my kind of teens. So it's always been very ingrained in me. And then I went on to study chemistry at university. And I mean, I never thought that I wanted to kind of do that as a job, but I kind of didn't know what I was doing. So I thought, right, I'll just spend some time studying something that I'm fairly good at and hopefully figure it out from there. In my final year at uni, I think that's when I started my fitness Instagram, kind of just posting like mirror selfies and like HIIT circuits and that kind of thing. And I also started doing my personal training qualifications. In that final year, that's when COVID hit. So we got kind of sent home and I kind of finished my degree at home. I started kind of applying for grad jobs and that kind of thing. And I was getting rejected and, you know, having that kind of like crisis moment you have when you're out of that kind of education system and it's like, right, what now? And so I completed my PT qualifications and still I started up some online coaching because we didn't really obviously have much else to do during kind of lockdown. And from there, it's just kind of grown and I've not really looked back into, like I always imagined myself maybe more like in the corporate world and that kind of thing. But when things started to open up, I did some in-person work, group classes and that kind of thing. And then I've been fully online, you know, online coaching now for about, I'd say 3.5 or 4 years fully online. So yeah, that's a bit of an overview.
Was online coaching a thing that was on your mind prior to kind of exiting your corporate pursuits, or was it something that was kind of calling to you a little bit and you had maybe one foot in that, or was it like, hey, I'm really trying to go this route that didn't work out and then I'm going to begin trying to make this online coaching thing work? Were you straddling those two at any point?
Yeah, I think so. It was definitely a case of, okay, I'll start this online coaching thing, kind of see where it goes. And then, you know, when I was finding it really hard kind of grad job wise and just like things that weren't inspiring me, interesting me, all of that kind of thing, I was like, well, you know what, we're still in kind of lockdown, so I've got nothing to lose. I may as well kind of give this a go. And yeah, so it was, I guess, a bit of a silver lining that I was kind of in that situation where I could slightly more safely take that step, I guess.
Had you already been posting content prior to becoming a coach? You know, because I think that if you're asking somebody today, most people wouldn't just begin posting content for fun. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people do, but you're not putting a ton of time and effort into good, helpful content, you know, niching down and without it being something, you know, tangential to your business. Or were you just posting for fun and then became a coach? Or was it kind of the intent to become a coach while you were posting?
Yeah, I was kind of just posting for fun at first and sharing my own workouts and that kind of thing. And then I kind of gradually, maybe when I started doing my PT qualification, like found my niche a little bit more in a lot of like technique posts and that kind of thing. And that's kind of what really picked up, you know, my following was kind of around that time. And, you know, the whole like the green tick, red cross kind of post, like I was a big fan of back in the day. Yeah. They didn't work quite so well anymore, but you know, it was good for a moment, wasn't it?
Sure. That was a good wave to ride. And that's funny because that's what I think about when I think about your content, I think originally We all have a combination of we do what feels right to us, plus we do what works, and it's a bit of both for sure. And that's just how that's the business and the nature of the game. But I think of you very early on, a lot of technique content. And I think of myself as well, or not necessarily early on, but there was a phase where it's like, oh, it's super. If I scroll through my old content, sometimes, like once a week, I'll post something old, but I'm finding it harder and harder to like find an old piece of content that I would absolutely 100% stick by today. So, but I've been scrolling back over the last couple of months. I'll try and post something old once a week just to give myself a break. And I'm finding a lot of my old like technique content. Anyway, when I think about you and your content, that is, I think at some point that's how I found you. A lot of the really, really, really good technique content. Why was that a thing? Or how did you at that time become so passionate about that? Was that something that you took a course and you were like, oh, I got to post about this? Or I'm seeing other people, my clients are messing up with this stuff and I think it could be really helpful. Was there something that was an impetus to beginning making that sort of content?
Yeah, I think maybe I think I've probably always been quite good technique-wise myself, probably from having an athletic background. And you might find that, like, if you work with clients who have some kind of athletic background, like their bodily awareness and that kind of thing is just a lot better. So I think it was just something part of lifting that I was quite good at. And then I found when I started sharing it, it just got really good feedback. And I think a big, especially for women, I think a big fear of being in the gym is doing things wrong. And so for me, being able to say, okay, this is what you're doing, and I know you feel like XYZ and your lift looks like this currently, here are the tweaks we want to make. It just really seemed to work, and people really seemed to enjoy it. And it, like, yeah, I think the confidence that it gave to people was the feedback I was getting. And so I just kept building on that.
Yeah, and I'm not the way I'm saying this is not that you've changed your stance on those things being helpful or important, but if you're somebody who finds your content today, it's a smaller percentage of that stuff, let's say. Still in your content, I'd say it's still in my content, but it's a smaller percentage. Why would you say that is?
I'd say because as I've become a better and better coach, you realize that these things are important, but there's also, so much more to it. And I wanted to, show that, I guess maybe slightly selfishly, as a coach, I didn't just want to be an educational page. And I think to then go and want to work with someone, I wanted to show that actually, yeah, I'm more than just like, here's a right or wrong post that you're going to save and use in the gym, but like, here's what else I can offer and knowledge and that kind of thing. And as I've gained experience and worked with loads of people, you kind of learn more, and there's more I want to say than just, here's the right way to do an RDL. And I mean, there's only so many times you can tell someone how to do an RDL, I guess.
Totally. And I don't want to say that this is how you feel, but I will say that this is how I feel is that there was just a time where I will say it this way, I overemphasized the importance of the pursuit of some sort of optimal perfect technique. And so there was definitely a wave where that was a lot of people were doing that. And I certainly caught that bug. And yeah, ever since, it's not that I look back on that time, I'm like, oh, you were an idiot. You like totally like sold out to the pursuit of this optimal technique kind of wave. But I'm just in a different place right now where it's difficult for me to make like, I haven't even looked if you've done this lately, but I would do, let's say you mentioned like a green check, red X post, and then we both chuckle because we know what that is, which is like a, an RDL with like a bad technique, and it's got this like red X, and then there's like another, whatever, however you structure it, there's like another clip with a green check of doing it right. I probably wouldn't make that content at the same way today, but, and I would say because I've just maybe come down from being so high on that being how I want to communicate things from a technique perspective. Does any of that ring true for you?
Yeah, for sure. And I think when I was thinking about, maybe a future question about things I've changed my mind on is around, I'm so much more kind of sure that showing up and working hard is the sits at the top of everything. And, variation in technique, imperfect program, all of those kind of things just are a lot further kind of down the list of priorities. I realized, like, at the time there started to be a bit of kickback in terms of like the green tick, red cross kind of thing, saying, oh, is it kind of dissuading people, making increasing the barrier to entry for people and that kind of thing. I personally disagreed with that at the time because I felt like actually to show people like here is what your technique should look like, and so they can go into the gym with this post. And I personally felt like it was confidence building, but I can see, and I see, I think maybe women in particular, this overemphasis on trying to be perfect and move like a robot means that they never get anywhere close to muscular failure. That's really scared of like any deviation, etc. And so there's definitely a sweet spot to be found. But you know, that's a skill and it takes time and practice, doesn't it? But yeah, no, there's definitely a middle ground.
And there's also a tricky part with doing something like in a binary sense of like this is the right technique, this is the wrong technique for exercises where individual technique will look very different. So like if you want to do like here's a green check red X post on how to do a bicep curl, I think that you can do that. But if when we're dealing with people with different limb lengths and different mobility at the hip, at the knee, at the ankle, and then you're like, here's what everyone's RDL is going to look like, and then you get out in the real world and you tell 1,000 people to do an RDL, and you see that 1,000 people can have 1,000 correct RDL techniques that look totally different. It's that's what one of the things that got me was like, I'm just trying to like make these posts for split squats. A quad dominant back squat. Quad dominant back squat, if you get 10 fitness professionals who have great technique and you tell them to do a quad dominant back squat, it's going to look wildly different every single person. And so I did find that to be like, all right, if we want to do this for like exercises that have more constraints where it's going to look more similar from person to person, that's fine. But one of the things that made me deviate or just whatever, just move evolve my opinion on that stuff was having a group program where I was going from maybe having 20 to 50 one-on-one clients where we could really communicate and tinker and get in the nitty-gritty to like hundreds of people being like, oh, everyone looks insanely different when they do this. And there's a lot of versions that can be, you know, correct enough for us to not have to nitpick and work hard.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that's where trying to teach principles is better, maybe a bit less sexy for like Instagram engagement, but helping people understand the principles of movement patterns and that kind of thing is, I feel, something I've probably moved more towards.
Yeah. And just to close on this, I too see that side of things where one could say, hey, this is you know, I feel like I'm creating a bit of analysis paralysis where if I'm not doing it right, I'm not confident. But for the vast majority of people, I think doing the technique well enough is important. And if you can keep everything in context and understand that it's not binary, then I think those posts were fantastically helpful. Nothing short of really, really helpful. So no real regrets on that.
Sure.
Let's talk about your first marathon. And again, I was just thinking about what we were going to talk about over the last couple of days, and I'm like, all right, Jazz, how do I know her? Well, she started off posting amazing technique content, just unbelievable technique content, inspired me to do some technique content. And then slowly, all of a sudden, you know, she's like running a marathon, she's like posting some running content, and I was like, that's what I'm doing. I was like, that's me. I'm like fully in my like, you know, guy who used to, you know, be all about hypertrophy and stuff to like I want to also not, you know, get winded going up the stairs. So tell me how you've gone through that transition, what your training is like now, what your first marathon was like, and I'll pick and, you know, pick and choose stuff to roads to go down.
Yeah, sure. I feel like we're both following that typical pipeline, aren't we? Being like super hypertrophy focused, really. But I think, you know, part of it comes from, I think there's only, I don't know, there's only so long without being a professional bodybuilder or something that you can just keep showing up and doing the same thing, which is, you know, I love it. I just love lifting and I always will. But I think there was part of me, maybe partly when I stopped playing netball as well, that kind of something, I just was missing that extra bit of something. And I think the rise of running and seeing that become more and more popular, which maybe we'll kind of talk about why we think that's happening, but it just kind of appealed to me. And so even though for ages I'd always said that I wasn't a good runner, like I was never the fastest, I was never the like fittest in terms of my like skills as an athlete when I was younger, but I kind of, you know, it was nice to be able to pick up something and at least at the beginning be able to do it with relatively kind of minimal pressure on myself. And I mean, that's why. So I think I started about 3 summers ago, not so 3 years ago. And I didn't sign up for anything for a long time because I know myself. I know that I am competitive with myself. I know that I'll like take things pretty extreme. And so I didn't want to start hating it. I wanted to enjoy it. And so I spent quite a long time just kind of gradually building things up. And And then kind of, I think maybe I got up to about a half marathon distance 2 years ago. And then I guess just over a year ago, I kind of decided, right, like I know I can do the distances. I think I'm ready and I'd like to sign up for a marathon. So it's about like a year out that I signed up, and then did. I think by then I was running at kind of 3 times a week. And then as I started my kind of 16-week marathon block this January, up that to 4 times a week. So did that at the first marathon at the end of April, which went well. It went really well. So yeah.
Let's come back to the marathon in a sec. When you first started, you had an athletic background, so you probably had a familiarity with what your cardiovascular fitness was like, you know, or at least like a reference of who you are and where you are in your fitness. Did you have a plan? Did you just start going out for runs? Did you just I'm going to do one day of intervals, or I'll run walk, or was it just I don't was that not even pressure you wanted to put on yourself? You just wanted to go out there and enjoy being outside. Where did you start at, like, ground zero?
Yeah, so I think because as I said, having done a lot of network, like we ran a lot, we did a lot of running, we did a lot of like conditioning style running, like a lot of sprinting, like we did. So I knew I had that ability, and you know, when I was at home at Christmas, I would go on and run 5K with my dad. So I wasn't starting from nothing. So I think I just began. With probably like I can't remember the very first kind of runs, but I'm sure it was just kind of going out, doing a kind of relatively chilled 5K, and then relatively soon, because I guess you know when you're a coach yourself, it's hard to be chill about these things, and you already get invested in learning more about it and figuring out interval training and that kind of thing. So I think I probably started in introducing structure relatively soon. I was really purposeful about slowing down, and that really helped. And so I ran pretty like slowly for a good while there, and then it's been only in the last, I'd say, in terms of like my feeling like my pace is decent, maybe in the kind of past year, and things like tempo work, interval work, and that kind of thing have been so helpful in having that kind of structure. But I think, as I said, because of being in, you know, working in the fitness world, and also I think my personality, I'm quite, you know, I'm quite sciencey. I like to get invested and learn about these things. I think I probably did it, start including kind of structure to my running relatively soon.
How did it affect your lifting? Did you just layer on some running on top of what you were already doing? Did you change anything to make room for running in your schedule, either from a time perspective or like fatigue management perspective, or you just did both?
Yeah, so oh yeah, so I must have dropped a lift because I think I was lifting 5 days a week. I think I was doing 3 lower body days per week. I can remember back to those times. I was so attached to having 3 lower body days per week. I had to do like 3 different hip thrust variations. So I was so attached to that kind of thing back then. It's, you know, funny thinking about that. So dropped a lifting session so that I could, and I think I probably started with 2 runs a week. But I'd say, you know, within the last, I think sometimes people stress out perhaps a little bit too much about, okay, well, how am I going to juggle it all when I start running? And sometimes it is just a case of it's okay to just kind of start. And at first, you're not going to be doing any massive distances and that kind of thing. And you might be able to just kind of add some work on top of what you're doing, see how your body feels, how's your energy? Maybe let's increase your food a little bit if you're feeling, you know, slightly more hungry, or if your body weight starts to go down and that kind of thing. And I think sometimes people want to know the exact changes they should be making before they start. And I think, you know, sometimes it is just a case of getting started. And I've, you know, even throughout my marathon training, I've managed to still, I lifted 4 days a week and ran 4 days a week. I am so aware coaching people that the position I'm in, being self-employed, to have that freedom of time, just it makes it so, it's so different versus clients I'm coaching who are working the 9 to 5s, have dependents and families, and they're fitting in around that. So I try to like caveat that when I talk about it on social media and that kind of thing, because it's not going to be the same, and not everyone's going to have that time. But you know, one thing that I've really noticed that has, you know, I think made a really big difference for me with my running is I really think the years of like smashing my lower body in the gym has made such a big difference in terms of my ability to recover from runs. After the marathon, like my legs were not that bad, and I really do put a lot of that down to having like strong legs for a long time.
Did you, other than just maybe going down from high lower body volume to like more moderate lower body volume, did you change anything other than maybe just doing a little bit less to make room for another stimulus and stress in your life?
No, I think probably I was volume-wise probably brought things down a bit. Over time I've just become more and more quality focused, and if I can get away with two working sets, I definitely will. A lot more kind of bang for buck, and I guess a lot more happy within my lifting for some things to be slightly more, maybe more towards maintenance volumes, and I'm just not as intent about optimizing everything kind of hypertrophy wise. And I think, I've really enjoyed showing people and myself that you don't have to put yourself in that box. And I think I definitely did put myself in a bit of a box before. And, breaking that idea that kind of cardio kills gains, breaking that down. And also, I mean, even if I could have probably built more muscle if I hadn't been doing all this running, I'd imagine I might have had more time for my lifting. There are probably lifting sessions where I'm more tired, or maybe I've got like less mental energy to put towards it because it's being a bit more thinly spread across the week. But I'm kind of like, well, who cares if it is my muscle building is a bit slower or suboptimal now, and I just don't care about that so much anymore. And I mean, none of us are pro athletes or pro bodybuilders, and so you kind of weigh those things up, I think.
Yeah, that all rings very true to me. And I personally feel like I got to a point with my lifting. By the way, somebody sent me a meme the other day where it's like when you hit 30, you go into like one of four houses, like Harry Potter houses, and it was like running, pickleball, Japan, or and something else. And I just was like, that's like so unbelievably true. And I just think it's a very cliche, but there's going to be a percentage of people that fall into this bucket. Once you're in your like mid to mid early 30s, if you have been somebody who's been lifting for a long time, you've built a high percentage of the muscle that you could build. You've been lifting for 15 years or something like that. The stuff you'd have to do for the return you would get is not super great. You'd have to train, and it's not that the volume goes up forever, but you'd have to really be, you can't be scraping minimum effective dose 15 years into training. I mean, a minimum effective dose does change, of course. It's a relative term, but you have to train hard. It has to be your main focus. You're almost certainly going to have to pursue some weight gain. And I got to the point where I was like, if I were to paint the picture of hey, I really want to make some good gains from here 15 plus years in, if I look at that list of things, the return, the ROI, it's not great. It's a lot of effort for marginal gain. And I think I just got to the point where I was like, well, why don't I put some of that on maintenance, do a lot less of it, and I can actually get really great ROI at something I suck at. It's like, hey, I'm gonna start running. I suck at running. So I run 2 or 3 times a week, and look, I can get 100% better in 2 years or whatever it is. And then, that's around the age where, again, it's all cliches and generalizations, but it's where people are thinking more about, they see their parents getting older. Maybe they're starting a family and they're thinking about wanting to be around for a bit longer. And all of a sudden, it becomes about health now. Instead of being an egomaniac like 22-year-old, and I just think all of those things triangulate into like people in their early 30s just being like, hey, like it's maybe it's time for me to not again not get winded going up the stairs. Do you nod along with any of that?
100%, definitely. And I think, as you said, because as time goes on, your kind of ROI is massively reducing, and then going into something new like that, running is, and maybe even for a longer kind of period, it's very rewarding, isn't it? When you hit that first 5K, and when you hit that first, like, I remember that feeling of being on the kind of 9K, getting towards 10K, and thinking, oh my goodness, I'm about to run, like I'm about to complete 10K. And I hadn't felt like that in a while from lifting. And so it does really just bring that different sense of achievement. And I think that's probably, partially why it's become more and more popular. It's very tangible, the progress. I guess there's that kind of community aspect to it as well. And I think people like, they like pushing themselves, and they like They like being able to set standards for themselves and complete certain things. I mean, it, not that long ago, I feel like running a half marathon, running a marathon, it seemed like something reserved for pro athletes. But now it's different. I mean, I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it? It's almost so normal. I don't mean, maybe it's just my algorithm, but it feels like everyone's running a marathon every other weekend. And so sometimes you can just think, oh, it's quite a standard thing to be doing. But I do think like net social media has been really positive for just spreading that most people with some time and practice, whatever body, whatever background you're from, it's relatively low barrier to entry, and most people can like get pretty good at running.
And I love that post about running can be a commodity sport. Honestly, in a way that lifting can be, everything can be, and sometimes little knickknacks and fun things are motivating. And I actually quite like leaning into that when it's doesn't you know when it's not so cost prohibitive, when it's not so expensive. Buying a nice little tiny shiny, let's say buying this like water bottle that I'm drinking, which is like a $30 water bottle. But I use it every day, and it makes me more motivated to drink. So I like that sort of treat yourself. If it's gonna make you more motivated to just buy a nice pair, whatever it's running shoes, or for lifting, it's like you nice pair of lifting straps or a belt or whatever it is. I like that. But in running, it's even more a commodity sport. There's way more of an opportunity, in my opinion, to, well, I guess it goes both ways. But with running, it's just like it is potentially a thing that you just lace up and go do, but we have absolutely turned it into a commodity sport where it's like you talked about shoe rotation in your thing. You talked about how many, listen, and I'm having fun with experimenting with certain things, but I see how quickly it can become something where you're racing the pursuit of more tech and more gear and more shit. And so I like that. I love that you made that post. It was like, hey, I just went out there and I just ran a bunch, and I still really like it, even if I didn't have like a fancy carbon plated neon shoe. And so I really, really did appreciate that post. If somebody was starting today, either a completely sedentary person who's doing neither lifting or running, or someone who's lifting and would like to incorporate some running, or is running and wants to incorporate some lifting, what if you have a client who's like, hey, I see what Jazz is doing, and I'm intrigued by doing both. What are some of, I don't want to hold you to something as specific as a core value, but like, what are some things that principally come to mind for you as like, hey, like these are some of the things that I find important when somebody's trying to do both of these things and they're just starting out?
Yeah, sure. So I think the first thing is that right at the beginning, you probably won't be able to keep running for that long. And have it like a full kind of cross training is probably going to be quite a useful tool. So oftentimes, if I'm working with people who are just starting out running, we'll do some walk runs and we'll be doing some other forms of cardio work, some off-feet cardio, some time on the bike, elliptical, stairs, and that kind of thing, because that's a way of building up that volume. If we're just trying to see how long we can run for, it's going to take you quite a long time to be progressing that, because it's hard to get going with that. It's interesting. Sometimes you've got those very beginners, and that's maybe one story. Quite a lot of clients I work with are maybe good lifters, experienced lifters, and they want to enter the running world. And so they're probably quite fit. We might have been doing some other cardio in their programming, some conditioning circuits and that kind of thing. So they're probably their lungs are in a pretty good place. Mentally, they know how to push themselves. So all of that side is maybe above where their body is at, because as you know, running is super high impact. And so actually sometimes it's a case of holding those people back a little bit and saying, okay, yeah, whilst your lungs and your brain may be able to go faster and go further, actually your joints, your tendons, all of those kind of structures of your lower body, they're not quite there yet. And so things like incorporating plyometric work into their gym programming, I've found really valuable. Again, getting some more volume in terms of that, the kind of building that those, that strength in the tendons, etc., because of that kind of impact, building the explosiveness, and making sure their programming is even, it feels pretty easy to start with, and that they're, that it's gradually building up over time. I found is super important too. I think you've got to become a little bit more careful or considered about how you program and how you're training sessions are spread throughout the week naturally. I often encourage people to be clear on their priority because I think if you're doing both, I think you do have to accept some level of you might not be perfectly fresh for every single session you do. And so, during marathon training, maybe I was protecting my harder run and my long run. Maybe outside marathon training, I might have been protecting my lower body days more. And I then accept that sometimes I might be running on slightly sore legs. And so I think being aware of which is your priority is quite useful as well. And obviously, there's the nutrition component as well. I think people would love to know how many calories should I increase by when I start running? And unfortunately, there's no defined answer to that. But obviously, with more the higher energy demands and recovery demands as well, we have to make sure and look at how kind of their body's feeling, how they're responding, and make sure that kind of we're aligning nutrition with those changes as well.
Yeah, that's incredibly well said. And at the cost of people getting annoyed with me that all I'm talking on this podcast is about is running lately, because that's just like it's hysterically like where I'm at as well. We'll pivot to talking a bit about we have a couple things I want to talk about. I definitely want to talk about perfectionism. I think that that's something that you'd mentioned that you are working with. I mean, as a coach, that's a thing that people on average are, and we even talked about a little bit with the pursuit of the perfect technique. Where does this perfectionist mindset come up with clients? Where does it manifest itself, and how do you work with people to get through that?
Sure. So I think this, I guess this kind of type A personality, perfectionist is often very drawn to, health and fitness pursuits. And there, I'm sure you know that there is this line between all of these things being really, really positive, healthy, 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 healthy. And it's like, okay, where does it cross that line where it is becoming something I beat myself up about if I miss it, or it's causing me a lot of stress, or is making me feel bad about myself because I'm not living up to the standards that I've set for myself. And I think there's this inflection point that can sometimes be a bit difficult to kind of figure out where that is. On the other side of things as well, I think maybe a lot of people feel that they're an all or nothing type person. They're either off track or on track. And I think a big reason for this and a big thing that I talk about with my clients is your concept of what on track is just focused on the health and fitness things and doing those perfectly. And you're not thinking of yourself as an entire person. And what are your other, yes, that's a big priority for you and that's great. But what are your other values and priorities in your life, in your career, your relationships, memories you want to make, travel you want to have? Okay, if we see ourselves as this whole person, well, would a month being perfectly on track, training nutrition wise, perfect tracking every day, never missed a training session, well, is that on track for who you want to be as a whole? Because that would have meant you didn't go out to dinner with your friends at all, and you maybe didn't go and stay at your parents for the weekend. And so, what I really try to do is help people find that middle ground. And I think sometimes it's scary because it might feel like, oh, well, I don't want to lose my discipline. Actually, by being so rigid, it shoots people in the foot because whenever they fall short, they go, oh, well, I can't do that today, so screw it. I'll just start again tomorrow. I'll start again on Monday. And it's that headspace, that, fuck it buckets, excuse my language, kind of approach that really impacts people when it could have just been a lunch out that they didn't tell themselves was a terrible thing or a bad thing. And they could have moved on with, the rest of their day. Actually, you could have, still tracked for the rest of the day, even though I couldn't track lunch, for example. So I do quite a lot of work with people on that. And it's complicated for people. And I think it's hard, but thinking of being clear with them of who they are as a whole person and all of their values and who we're working towards becoming, what does she or he look like as a whole? I think that's a really good start point.
Yeah, and some of you answered this next question in part just now, but I'm curious if there's anything more. I think it can be tricky because, missing, you can call it discipline, and discipline can be great. And you can say, I have this goal, and so I'm going to, either not go out to eat tonight, or I'm going to dramatically, or drastically modify what I'm ordering, or I'm not going to drink, or and everything, like disordered is in the eye of the beholder is a thing I believe. So I think you can frame that as discipline, and in some contexts it can be really great. And it's a net positive and you enjoy it. In other ways, it might feel that way, but it is actually a net negative in your life, and it's holding you back from your best life. And how do we help people figure out which one of those two things it is? Because if someone's like, hey, I'm going on vacation, I really want to track my calories. You know, I as a coach, I have a knee jerk of like, hey, that's probably not part of your best life, but I respect the pursuit of the discipline. And where am I the one who makes that decision as your coach? Are you the one who should make that decision? Where and how do we help people think about that and decide for themselves, you know, what's my best life? Is this a thing that's holding you back or adding to it? Or is there anything that you look out for as a coach?
Yeah, sure. And just as you said, what is people can be coming from at this literally from the opposite side. And for some people, actually not going out for that meal and deciding to cook from home, that's the better option for them. And then for other people, it would be the complete opposite. And so there is no black and white when it comes to that. And I guess that is why, I guess the way I coach is very holistic, I guess, because I have to understand the person and the context to help them decipher that, and putting forth questions to get them to then reflect. And almost, I guess, sometimes I try to act as a bit of a mirror. So I'll kind of reflect some of the things they're saying, maybe framing things slightly differently. And I think that in turn then helps people come to those conclusions. But, you know, as you said, it's not for me to decide or tell them either way. But I think opening up thoughts for people is probably the best way that we can do that. But it is, as you said, it's not like we could make a piece of content and it would say, this is how you should approach going on holiday. You shouldn't track when you go on holiday, or you should be tracking, or you should be training when you, it's not possible, is it?
Yeah, I think there's a foundation of people understanding what certain goals will cost. So like helping people manage expectations. And what, like the term, how bad do you want it? To me, I use that phrase, but I make a point that it's not a pump-up speech. I think that quite often is like, how bad do you want it? It's supposed to be a pump-up. It's not. It's like a legitimate question that you need to ask, which is how bad do I want that thing? And what is it going to cost? And for how long? And what sort of trade-offs? And is that the life I want to live? And I find that to be an incredibly important thing to do and be introspective about, especially with what we're doing, because fitness takes time, and, you know, eating, you know, everything you do for your health has an opportunity cost. It's things you do instead of other things. And we have to put those things into some sort of value structure. And I just think that sometimes, do you ever maybe get a hunch that you think a client's going down a path that maybe isn't what's absolutely best for them? And they're maybe talking themselves into the, hey, this is what I really want to do. I really want to track on vacation. I really want to do this. And in some ways, allow people to experiment with taking things a bit too far to kind of recalibrate what for them is moderation. Or do you try to prevent them? What do you do in a scenario where somebody, maybe you think, my gut's telling me that's a bridge too far in terms of these trade-offs, but maybe we allow you to experience that, and that can be a net positive long term. Is that something you feel you have happens with clients?
Yeah, for sure. And I think you know, as coaches, we're not here to dictate what someone is doing. I feel like I'm more here to help show them both sides and show them maybe other possibilities that they hadn't considered, because maybe they were in a place where they thought, well, I have to track whilst I'm away, surely. And maybe to open up other possibilities. And then, yeah, you know, if they do want to go ahead and do that, we can reflect on it together, you know, when we check in, when they're back, and we can think about how that went, and I can help them reflect on how the rest of the holiday went and whether they were present and that kind of thing. But it's a gradual process. And I don't think, you know, when someone's of that mindset, you can't say one thing and kind of click your fingers and suddenly change that. But equally, I'm not, for some people, the messaging, I've got clients that I like the saying, I say, if you want above average results, you're going to have to do above average things. And that is so applicable to a large part of the population as well. And you know, if you've got big goals, then you've got to do things out of the norm. But you have to decide if those things are worth it. You have to be self-aware enough, I guess, to see the other areas of your life that might suffer from it. And I think as a coach, you just have to highlight those things and put them forward to someone and give them those tools, basically.
Do you look, I mean, you're obviously in great shape, and that takes a lot of effort. Do you look back at a time where not a definitively were a little extreme, but maybe back when you did things in a certain way that you look back on now and you're like, well, maybe I was a little extreme. Do you ever look back on those things in a certain way with regret or as a learning experience? Have they impacted you and who you are today and how your relationship with fitness, we'll say?
For sure. Yeah. So actually, in my late teens, I had an eating disorder. So I feel like I come at it from a place of I know how far it can go and I know the headspace that can be attached to that. And I think for me, a lot of that did come from a perfectionist tendency in me and like a desire to control things as much as I could. Particularly in like tumultuous times, it kind of like would flare up around things like exam times because I was put a lot of pressure on myself. And so it would be that kind of thing. And so I think when you've been there, you can see tendencies maybe or thought processes in other people. And that, I guess that's part of the reason why I'm so passionate about helping people find that middle ground. It is all about perspective, isn't it? It's easy for me to say now that those things that I was so stressed about and the way I used to feel around eating out or going on holiday or the way I had to track, like all of those kind of things, at the time, it feels like the most important thing in the world. And it's easy to look back on it in hindsight. So I guess I like to just, if I see any of those like thought patterns in people, I guess maybe just like fast track the process of having more perspective for them a little bit more, I guess is like what I like to think that I'm doing.
Yeah, I just recorded a podcast about things that I would do differently if I was starting my fitness journey over. And as I was making the list, I was like, yeah, but I'm not mad about that. And yeah, I'm not mad about that. And I'm not mad about that. And so I led the podcast with a preface of just like yeah, I wasted time or I did things that weren't great, but I don't ultimately look on that with regret. And that's mostly because I'm in a good place now and I can appreciate how some of those things had that, but I also truthfully, I'm like, if I could have that experience without or having those periods take less time. And that's what we're doing as coaches, is like, hey, we might be taking one step into that, a little bit over the edge on this side and over the edge on this side to try and find where your happiest life is. But, like you said, just trying to expedite that process a little bit, not have to go through like years of, doing stupid shit. On the topic of, overdoing it, disordered eating habits, eating disorders straight up, we mentioned skinny talk. And hysterically, I'm not on TikTok, but like obviously not exactly rocket science to figure out like kind of what that hashtag is. I don't know if you saw this, but today, TikTok blocked that hashtag. Did you know that? So they blocked the tick. So I don't even know what it is. You're going to explain what's going on over on the TikTok. But the TikTok has blocked searches for hashtag skinny talk. Basically a tag that was fast track to content glorifying eating disorder. So if you search hashtag skinny talk, allegedly, I have not been on TikTok to confirm this, but if you search it, it redirects you to mental health support. So one, let's just take one step back. What is skinny talk? And two, I'd love for you to reflect on that decision.
Yeah, so okay, well, I'll be the resident
Yeah.
Gen Z
Thank you.
correspondent
Thank you.
in the trenches here. Yeah, so as you said, pretty self-explanatory. Skinny talk is basically a kind of rising trend where, thin women often, white women are using kind of tough love to teach other people how to be skinny like them. It's tips, it's tricks, it's quote unquote motivational videos. Some of the advice is kind of like mouth taping to avoid eating or eat whatever you want, just as little of it as possible, or rules around like how many bites of dessert you're allowed to have. Like sayings like, what is it? Stop treating yourself with food, you're not a dog, all of that kind of thing. Very reminiscent of diet culture of the noughties. You know, it's back and it's just packaged in a different form, really. So that's kind of what Skinny Talk is. So interestingly enough, there's one creator, and so she's the creator of the Skinny Society, Skinny with an I, of course, on the end. And so she was banned from TikTok, I think last year, and then she moved over to Instagram, and she had this subscriber broadcast channel, where I think she was earning about $130,000 a month, from this broadcast channel, this Skinny Society. And very recently, maybe last month, she just got demonetized on there, so kind of lost that. So this all kind of kicked up. So I think an article kind of got published where a reporter kind of went into the channel and kind of exposed some of what was going on there. And it's really rough. It's really rough stuff. You know, lots of tips on how to avoid eating. Apparently it was kind of very competitive. People complaining of things like dizziness and losing periods and losing hair were kind of just advised to start taking vitamin gummies and that kind of thing. So I guess, you know, this TikTok kind of putting restrictions around that search is like maybe unsurprising to me, because I've seen, I guess they obviously banned this creator last year, Meta kind of taking action around that. And I think they have to. I think they have to do something about it, because I think it's super dangerous, and I think they have a responsibility to kind of protect, particularly because of the I'm sure that the kind of community of people are going to be young and really impressionable, and I think there's a necessity to kind of protect them from seeing that kind of content.
Yeah, and I want to amend something I said earlier, which was that disordered is in the eye of the beholder, and that I think that that is a philosophy that very generally with I stand behind, but there the more extreme a piece of advice becomes, the more sure I would call it disordered. But I and where I'd primarily utilize that phrase is more in the gray areas of things like, should I track on vacation? And, you know, should I not drink tonight? Or should I not have the bread at dinner? And just those sorts of more moderate decisions that one might make, and to reflect on how I'd use that phrase to reflect back to the client to think about how that makes them feel, and understand that, yeah, okay, there's, listen, I've just been in the background Googling. First of all, I was on a deep, dark rabbit hole on netball. Now I'm in a deep, dark hole on skinny talk here. And some of the pieces of advice are just obviously insane. Like, you know, if your stomach is growling, like pretend like it's applauding you. Like that's like a very classic thing. And, you know, to be small, eat small. Like you don't need a treat. You're not a dog. These sorts of things. Like, yeah, for the most part, this is disordered pretty blanketly. And so I just want to backtrack some of that statement there and reframe that it's, I'm talking more about more moderate decisions that you might feel a little bit differently than somebody else. And I think there's room for individualization there.
Definitely. And I think the water becomes a bit murky, and you know, the people defending a skinny talk, they say, oh, well, no, it's just about, well, at least we're not lying to people. You know, we're telling people how this actually works. Of course, there is, you know, a broken, what is it? A broken clock is right kind of twice a day. There's things about walking and portion control and not, you know, not always having to eat when you're not hungry. Like, okay, that's the all, that is fine. But it's how it's all packaged, it's, you know, all of it kind of together that makes it dangerous. And I think it's really difficult, you know, having been there, it's really difficult when you're in the depths of that to see outside of it and to have that understanding of like what's going on, and you know, disordered eating and that kind of thing, that it thrives off kind of competition. And I think that's that this kind of comparison online, then I'm sure in that kind of subscriber group on Instagram that she had as well, I'm sure it was you know, that's where kind of like a disordered eating would or an eating disorder would kind of go to thrive, really.
Yeah, it feels a bit like there's a huge collateral damage, and this I'm thinking immediately of the carnivore diet, and if we want to have any words on that, but I just think that there will be like a couple of truths thrown in, and the person making all of the content seeing what seems to be positive responses, and not realizing that there's so much collateral damage that goes unheard and people being harmed that goes unheard and unamplified. And so you might say, no, 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 it's walking and portion control and you don't always need to eat when you're hungry and things that I could have said, you know, and but not understanding that the entire package of what you're saying has a ton of collateral damage that will go under discussed. Yeah, my daughter is one. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to get better, it's going to get worse, or if it's going to be different. You know, how much of this is infringement on freedom of speech? How much of, you know, and I'm happy that less people will interact with this content, period, end of story. I love the idea of, you know, forwarding people to more positive mental health spaces when they search for this. I love that. It's an interesting, you know, the freedom of speech argument is a slippery slope, and I understand that. And that's not one we're going to necessarily have here. All in all, I'm happy that this is a good idea. I think that this sort of moderating, like, I hope people can all get behind. Have you, I mean, I'm sure you will be seeing some of this in the TikTok space, but I can't imagine that this just like squashes it. You know, people will just change one letter and in a hashtag, and all of a sudden it's a new hashtag that means something different, and it will live on, unfortunately.
Yeah, of course. And you can, I mean, this creator was just a kind of a good example of it because she'd made this kind of brand around it and that kind of thing. But of course, there, you know, there are many people saying similar things with, you know, just in different kind of packaged up slightly differently. And it's trend driven, I guess. I think that there must be some kind of, it must stem or some relation to weight loss medication, the celebrities of the moment, how things are looking on the red carpet, and you know, these trends, like, unfortunately, particularly kind of women's bodies are, you know, cyclical trends, and one minute it's like big bum kind of Kardashian thing, and then the Kardashians look different and now they're all slim, and that kind of sets the tone, and I guess like the general pop are kind of a few steps behind and trying to keep up with that, really. So, but it's, I guess it's a form of showing status or showing, I don't know, it's a fashion trend, like things like Y2K, that kind of style is coming back, the kind of heroin chic. So I think that there's a reflection of kind of women's bodies on kind of what other trends are going on in kind of pop culture as well.
Yeah, at least the like fake butt trend was like getting people to get in the gym and lift heavy and eat more. And I don't think any trend is a positive for everyone, but I can support the net positive of that. And the minute the Kardashians are no longer on the like, I'm trying to make big butts in again, I'm trying to make, you know, heroin chic in again, then I think that's... There are, ironically, from a visual perspective, there are like more and less physiologically healthy things. Of course, the overemphasis of the external in general is a negative psychological space. But I think physiologically, we were better off when people were like, when big butts were in, and you know, women flocked to grab a barbell to do hip thrusts and eat to fuel and all that stuff. I think that was a bit of a more of a net positive. Let's get back to that.
Yeah, no, it is a shame. I think there's more and more of that rhetoric around, you know, the whole lifting makes you bulky kind of thing is definitely coming back, and like being a Pilates princess is coming, like, you know, the thing to be. It's really difficult for kind of, and I do think a platform like TikTok really sets fire under that and kind of emphasizes those trends and kind of following along with these different aesthetics and that kind of thing. Everyone feels like they're keeping up. So I do worry about, you know, I guess younger people managing that. I can't imagine being on kind of having something like TikTok when I was that age. I don't know. Obviously, I mean, it's kind of soon for you guys to be thinking about kind of social media and phones and that kind of thing. But I think it's a difficult decision for parents of deciding the restrictions or lack of restrictions, I guess, that you put around your children's kind of consumption of these things. It's a hard time.
Yeah, I agree. With the last couple of minutes here, let's talk a little bit about, we talked a little bit about your social media evolution, you know, just some of the things that you might have been more passionate about back in the day, but from a maybe how you coach or things you say to clients or just things you believe in the fitness space. What are some things that come to mind that you've changed? And sometimes people are like, oh, what have you changed your opinion on? And it's like, not always that I've done a 180. Like, I've changed my opinion on protein intake, but not from like, you got to eat a gram per pound to like, you don't eat, you need to be a fruitarian or whatever and never eat protein. But like, things change, things evolve. And what are some things that jump to mind for you? Maybe we'll just do a couple back and forth and we'll get you out of here on the hour. But some things that jump to mind for you that you've changed your mind on.
Yeah, sure. I think I've in general just become way less dogmatic about how people should train. As I said, at the beginning, I really thought everyone should train like a bodybuilder. I think like my first personal training clients, I trained everyone like they were a bodybuilder. I'm much more open to programming things for enjoyment and keeping people adherent and for fun. And I think all of those kind of things have a place. So I'd say that's one big kind of evolution is that just, and as I said at the beginning, I just don't think those things have to be perfect either to get really good results. And I think I've become more and more certain that intensity is one of the essential things that people need to work on. And as I said, that is a skill to build. And I think I do as much work on building that skill. Okay, what did that feel like at the end of the set? Why did we stop there? How did those final reps feel? I think they're things that people miss out. And building confidence in their technique and, reviewing their form clips, that kind of thing is important. But, encouraging people, okay, was it just the burn? Did I mentally tap out? Really encouraging people to think about those things has become more and more important for me as I've recognized that importance of like training intensity.
Yeah, I absolutely love that, and it's confirmation bias of just a slight leaning more towards caring about efficiency. And when you're talking about efficiency, what we're talking about is spending less time in the gym for better ROI, and the way you do that is by pushing yourself harder. And one of the things that I've found fruitful is almost if you just give somebody less sets, in a hysterical kind of way, it sorts itself out. Because I think people are subconsciously, what is it, Parkinson's law, where work expands to fill the time allotted, something like that. I think people's effort expands to the work given. And so if you give somebody 20 working sets, like you are by definition getting their best effort, but spread across those 20 sets. And if they had 8 sets for an entire workout, you'd get that same total amount of effort, but put into less sets, so higher intensity per set. And I found that funny where I just like gently start to lower people's volume, like without kind of saying something. Yeah, well, obviously I'm talking to my clients about it, but like, hey, let's try doing 2 sets of this and really give it your all. And all of a sudden, like progression, 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 like, oh my God, I didn't know I could push myself that hard. It's like, well, you were just doing what anybody would do. If you sit down to study for 8 hours, I bet you spend a good amount of that time putzing around. But if you give yourself 1 hour on the clock, you go on airplane mode and you get it done. And so I really love that one. And again, confirmation bias 100%, just been like a, finding myself, I don't have 2 hours in the gym 6 days a week anymore, like I did when we were, in high school or whatever. So yeah, finding myself leaning more towards that direction as well. Or any others come to mind for you?
I think they were the main ones for me, really. I'd thought about that as well. As just as you said, the more experienced and advanced a client is, the fewer sets that I'll program for them. And I just see so often, people are doing 4 working sets, 5 working sets of an exercise, and I already know what those sets look like when, because no one has that mental capacity to be able to do, a bit like what I said about when I've started running more and I'm doing harder runs, that was one thing that kind of changed in my lifting is just I still managed to keep a good amount of strength and muscle, but that mental juice that I had to kind of spread across the week was, a little bit, I didn't have quite as much of it. And it's the same thing, exact thing within kind of like working sets of exercises. I'm very much on board with that.
I think even in our conversation, we covered a few, which was like our obsession with perfect technique has evolved. The idea of how important cardio is in general. I mean, I would have been a person who said straight up, you can lift, walk, not eat too much, eat well, perfectly healthy. And I think that that is still something I'd stand mostly behind as like a really awesome way to, improve your health and, have good nutrition. you know, don't eat too many calories, lift weights, and walk a ton. Awesome. But I would amend that to like identifying a portion of that pie chart that is not filled, that you could fill with more intentional cardio. I might have left that part out five, six, 7 years ago. I think programming things for enjoyment, volume recommendations, or volume kind of intensity relationship, obsession with technique. Yeah, one for me has definitely been protein total and plant protein, insofar as it makes a huge meaningful difference in people's lives. Just like if you were to plot out every time, I mean, come on, how many times are people like, how much protein do I need to eat? And if you just took a graph and on the x-axis was time and on the y-axis was my recommendation, it just like is slowly getting lower where I'm like, yeah, I was like, oh, what, 1 point, well, you got at least a gram per pound in like, what is that, like 2015. And then every year it's just getting a little bit lower. And that's not just me. That's also just more data coming out that, you know, the certainty of where there's diminishing returns is low. And, you know, you can get a very high percentage of the total benefits of protein in terms of muscle building with less than we thought in that like 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilo, you know, and plant protein's cool too if you eat enough. And a lot of those things that I just, maybe a bit more of an ignorant person, an ignorant coach, younger, not as learned, might not have said. Yeah.
Definitely. But also, I think if you're not changing your mind over that time span as more research comes out and that kind of thing, then you're also kind of not a good coach as well. And I mean, you know, similar things as more research comes out around fasted training and how actually, you know, there doesn't seem to be a difference in terms of kind of muscle mass and that kind of thing. I think it's really important for coaches to be, you don't have to be, you know, citing PMIDs like every post, but to be up to date with these things, I think is so important. I don't envy people who consume fitness content because how the hell do you know who to trust? I think it's difficult, but I guess that's why, you know, people like us, we try to, and maybe that's why I guess my content has evolved and I have my own podcast and that kind of thing. You've got to show people as much of yourself as possible, that you're willing to adapt, you're willing to learn and change your mind a little bit and evolve as more of these kind of things come out, because what people thought was right 5 years ago might actually be different to now because we've got different evidence and we've got different practical anecdotal experience from ourselves, clients as well.
Yeah. And I hope people can sense a genuine updating of opinions and differentiate it from, you know, setting, you know, tying yourself to every mast that comes by of like, oh, this is the thing and then that's the thing, and to a more genuine like, hey, like this is what the totality of evidence looked like then and this is what it looks like now, and I'm updating my opinions. I think that if you're looking at your content and not, you know, I'll say it abruptly, but I don't think it's this true, which is like, yes, if you're looking at your content from several years ago and you don't think, I probably say that a little differently, then, and I don't want to do it because, you know, for all you know, you were making perfect content 3 years ago, absolutely perfect. But I do feel like every time I look back and I'm like, I don't really want to post any of this old stuff. Part of me is annoyed because I'm like, damn, if I had a really good post today, it saves me an hour or whatever. But I also feel like, yeah, that's because you are living and breathing this shit and updating yourself as, you know, as new stuff comes out. So anyway, why don't you tell people where they can find you? You are one of my favorite accounts on Instagram. Just a wonderful, wonderful follow. And yeah, I hope your account continues to grow. It deserves to.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, yeah, likewise. So yeah, it's at jazz.fitness_ on Instagram is kind of the main place you can find me. And then I do have a podcast as well, so you can find all the links to that kind of in my bio. But yeah, that's the main place I spend most of my time.
How, I'll just, if anybody's still listening, I'll sneakily just ask you, how fast do you run your marathon?
3:46.
That's fucking awesome. That's incredible. Wow. Good for you. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. How was your fueling and how was your whole experience? Stop. We'll do this another time. I took up too much of your time already. We'll do this another time. We'll chat offline, but I appreciate you coming on. It was really great. Great to meet you. Great to chat.
Yeah, fab to meet you, Jordan. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.